Okay, it's time to begin. Let's get started. Are there any questions? My wife made it for me. It's handmade tie. And this pin, this lovely silver pin with a lamb on it, that was also handmade by Leslie Hutchins. He used to be a PhD student of mine. He was very talented. He works for Google now. I keep asking, what are you doing? And he says, I can't tell you. Okay, any other questions? So just to review quickly, the class exam will be next Monday. Past exams are available on the website. Class exam will be in Lecture Theater 4, where we normally meet on Monday. Drop-in labs, we've extended the lab hours. I went through all this yesterday. And I told you that we were going to schedule an extra tutorial. It has now been scheduled. So it will be 4 to 5 p.m. tomorrow in Appleton Tower, this building, room 412. So that's the fourth floor, room 412. If you want to go to the extra tutorial, please go to the website today, download last year's class exam, and have a go at doing the class exam, and then bring your solutions printed out. Right, you can have a go on a computer and bring your solutions printed out to the tutorial, and we'll review them there. So anybody who feels like they need a little bit of extra attention, we've got an extra tutorial for you. Any questions about any of that? Yes. Just show up. I'm hoping we won't have more people than fit in the room. Okay. And just to check, we tried to schedule that so it didn't conflict with anybody. Does anybody have a conflict with that time? Looks like not. Good. They're the reading assignments, you know that. That's me. That is the tie I'm wearing, which, as I already mentioned, was handmade by my wife. So at the end of today, you will understand why I have a handmade tie made by my wife that has lambdas all over it. So we went through all that last time. I'm not going to do any of that. Are there any technical questions from last time that people want to ask? Because we went through quite a lot quickly. Yes? Is the function transposed in the standard prelude? Yes, it is. That's not a question from yesterday. That's a question from the tutorial. So we saw the functions map, filter, and fold. And we went through currying. I just want to go through fold very quickly again, because after explaining it to you, I thought, you know, I should have explained it slightly differently. So I'm just going to give you the slightly different explanation, thinking that since we went through some very heavy stuff last time, going through a little bit of it again wouldn't hurt. So I'm just going to quickly go through fold and currying again, if that's okay with people. Or will that bore everybody to tears? People like to see fold and curry again, quickly? Yep. Okay. So, you recall, right, the point is to find common patterns of usage and capture them. So here's the definition of sum. Here's the definition of product, which is very similar, right? The only differences are the identity that we return for the empty list and the operator we use to combine things are zero and plus for sum, one and times for product, and the empty list and the append operator for concatenate. So we can just capture that pattern, right, by making those two things into extra arguments. So we have an argument f, which is a binary operator, so it takes two arguments and returns a result, all of type A, and then the identity for that operator, which also is a value of type A. And then we take a list of A and compress that down to 1A. So if it's plus, these will all be, A will be integer. If it's times, A will be integer. If it's double plus, then we replace A by string, say, if it's a list of characters, or in general, a list of B for any B. Now, the thing that I didn't show you, which maybe will make things a little bit clearer, right, is plus, times, and double plus are all written infix, whereas I've written F prefix, right? So F takes two arguments, x, and then the result of recursively folding the tail. But of course, we can, if we want to, write F infix, right? Because we're always allowed to write something in back quotes in between instead of in front. Do people remember the infix trick? And does seeing it that way help a little bit, understanding that can go in the middle like that, just like all the other operators? Go if that helped a little bit. And go if you're more confused than ever now. Nobody's shaking their head. Okay, that's good. But one person shaking their head, slightly. So, right before I said fold R of add and 0 and x's, but of course add is exactly the same as the built-in function plus. Remember I told you that plus with parentheses around it is a function, right? And when we write x plus y, that's just the same as plus applied to x and y. Right? And it's exactly the same trick with f, right? F applied to two things, x and fold R, is the same as writing F in back quotes between two things, X and fold R. So just two different notations for the same thing. And so now we can write sum, product, and concat as fold R plus 0 and applied to the three arguments, times 1 and X's, and double plus empty list and X's. Okay. And I've added some things to notes that's how the stupid computer would work out sum in detail, and how the stupid computer would work out fold R in detail. Okay, and then we saw that we could combine all those, right? So if we want something like the sum of the square, oops, damn. The sum of the squares of the positive numbers, that should be squares written out in full. We can actually write it as a three functions applied to each other. We can write it with a comprehension. We can write it with recursion. Or now we can write it with higher order functions. So fold R, map, and filter applied to the appropriate arguments. And then we saw currying, right? Currying is the weirdest thing you've seen yet. So here's a just slightly different way of explaining it. You can always get a function of two arguments by writing a function of one argument that returns a function of the other argument. So here's how to do that, for instance. So f takes an integer, and it returns a function from integers to integers. I just want f to do addition. So f of x is g, where g of y is x plus y. So that means f applied to 3 and 4 really means f of 3 applied to 4. And f of 3 is this g with x replaced by 3. So f of 3 is g, where g of y is 3 plus y. So it's the add 3 function. We apply that to 4, and we get 3 plus 4, which is 7. And as I mentioned, this is named for Haskell-Curry, which the programming language Haskell is also named for. So Haskell-Curry was a logician, as were Moses Schoenfinkel and Gottlob Frege. Right. So the whole trick in currying is that if I write a definition like this, it's actually shorthand for a definition like this. So if I say a function takes two integers and returns an integer, what that really means is it takes an integer and returns a function from integers to integers. And then a way we can put this to work, I should have written the infix definition here. A way we can put this to work is, notice the definition of fold R is it takes one thing and two, takes three things and returns an A. So really we should think of it as it takes this and returns a function from this to this, which is so on. But an easy way to think of it is, if we, right, you can always parse it up any way you want. So let's think of it this way. Foldar takes an operator and an identity element, and it returns, right, we had thought that it takes an operator, identity element, and a list of A, and it returns an A. But we can think of it as it takes an operator and an identity element, and it returns a function, which expects a list of A and returns an A. So since we can think of Foldar of two things as a function from a list to this thing, then we could just write sum. Instead of saying sum of x's is Foldar of plus 0 and x's, we can just say, well, sum is Foldar of plus and 0, and leave out the x's. Right? Sum is a function that expects a list of int and returns an int. And how do you compute it? It's Foldar of plus and 0. So if we use the first definition, then the stupid computer says, oh, I need sum, and I need its argument, and then I can rewrite it as the right-hand side. If we write it this way, it's just slightly shorter. Right? It says, oh, sum just gets rewritten as Foldar plus and 0. The argument just stays there, and then that gets used when we apply the definition of Foldar. So we can just think at a slightly higher level. We don't need to think of the arguments at all. Right? We can just now think that sum is a Foldar of plus and 0, product is a Foldar of times and 1, and concat is a Foldar of double plus and the empty list. So we can work at a slightly higher level there. The particular, if you write something in terms of, here's the argument, here's what you do with the argument, this old style. Where did it go? Here. This style, where you actually give the arguments, is called the pointed style, because we're saying what happens at each possible argument. If you've abstracted away from that, so you're just thinking at the functional level, and we're thinking totally of functions as functions, without worrying about the individual data points at which they operate, this is called the pointless style. So, at last we get to lambda. So remember we saw this example of putting three things together, right? We want to find the sum of the squares of the positive numbers. So we would write it just like that. And sum is easy, right? We just write the plus sign. But for square and positive, we need to define functions that define the square of x and what it means for x to be positive. So you might, it's very natural to think, I want to abbreviate this in some way. Why do I need to define these things? Can't I just write it in place? So you try to write it in place, and we'll say map of, instead of saying map of square, we'll say map of x times x. And instead of saying filter, we'll we'll say filter of x greater than 0. That makes sense, right? Very natural thing to do. What will happen if you type this into the computer?
X isn't a
It will say, x? What's x? I don't know from x. You've not given me a binding occurrence of x. So it just doesn't know what this x is at all. So this makes no sense. What we meant to say is not x times x, but assuming x is the argument, return x times x. So we need some way to say, assuming x is the argument, return x times x. And the way we do that is we say backslash x arrow x times x. So backslash x arrow means assuming that x is the argument, the value of the function is x times x. Assuming that x is the argument, the value of this function is true if x is greater than 0. Why on earth do we write a backslash? Well, backslash is the closest thing on our keyboard to lambda, a Greek letter. Why do we write a lambda? Nobody knows. Alonzo Church, when he first had to write out the lambda calculus, he looked for a letter that nobody else was using. Lambda wasn't used very much, so he picked that one. That's why it's lambda. Functional programmers learned this idea from Lisp, where it's also called lambda, written out, L-A-M-B-D-A. And I know where that came from, because I was fortunate enough to take a class as an undergraduate at Stanford from John McCarthy, the inventor of Lisp. John McCarthy had, when a student, taken a class from Alonzo Church. And when they were developing Lisp, somebody said, you know, we really want something that's just an expression that stands for a function. We just need something to put at the front to say, this is a function, and then the variable name, and then the expression to evaluate. And McCarthy said, wait a minute. He said, hold on. And he went back, and he looked it up in his notes, and he came back the next day, and he said, we'll call it Lambda. Okay? So that's why it's called Lambda. In standard ML, they call it function, which maybe makes more sense. But that's why we do it. So logicians would write, what we write is lambda x arrow x greater than 0. They would write as lambda x dot x greater than 0, and similarly for times. This is very cool, by the way, right? It means you're using a programming language that was designed in 1933. That's when the first paper on lambda calculus appeared, which, if you think about it, is about a decade before computers appeared. And the first computers, right, were done, among others, by Alan Turing, who'd come up with abstract mathematical models of what a computer should do, trying to answer deep questions that were important in logic. And indeed, Turing went to study with Church. Okay, so there is a direct line from all this to modern day computers. But I think it's just really cool using something that was designed before there were computers. That has to be good. I guess I feel that that's good mainly because you look at so many things designed for computers and you think, yeah, anything designed before computers must be better. So the way evaluating a lambda expression works, right, it's just a function. And so it works the same as any other function. You take the formal and you replace it by the actual. So in this case, the formal parameter is x. The actual parameter is 3. So if you have lambda x, x greater than 0, the stupid computer says, take the x, replace it by 3. So we've got 3 greater than 0. And of course, that's true. Similarly, lambda x, x times x, take the 3 x, replace it by 3. So you get 3 times 3, which is 9. This gives us a nice way of understanding currying, right? Because we can think of the plus function as lambda x, lambda y, x plus y. So a function of two arguments is a function of one argument, lambda x, that returns a function of the other argument, lambda y. So when we write lambda x, lambda y, x plus y applied to 3 and 4, that's really, the parentheses go as if that was that function applied to 3, and then the result applied to 4. So what happens if we take lambda x applied to 3? Well, we just get this bit here with x replaced by 3. So it becomes the function lambda y 3 plus y, which of course is the function that adds 3 to things. We then replace the y by 4. We've got 3 plus 4, which gives us 7. So lambda expressions gives us a way of talking about what currying is doing, because this thing here, lambda y x plus y, is the function that's returned from lambda x. Question?
I guess the lambda function doesn't check for the type. And if not, when does it, if you try to give that like a character or something, when would you get an error?
So what happens with types? The answer is that the Haskell system works out all the types before you try to run the program. So it just works out that there is a type for this. It always works out, remarkably, it can always work out the right type. Turns out there's always exactly one. That was a theorem proved by Robin Milner, who used to be a professor here. So it can always work out the best possible type, and it just uses that. So if there's no type, then you know there's something wrong and you need to try to find out what it is. The general rule for evaluating lambda expressions that we've seen, right, is If you have a lambda expression, lambda xe, where e is some arbitrary expression, applied to some other arbitrary expression d, it just means take x and replace it by d when evaluating e. The other way we can write that in Haskell is let x equal d and e. So that's the general rule. This is sometimes called the beta rule. I'm going to skip over this. We'll go back, depending on how the rest of the lecture goes. But now I want to go back and talk in a little bit more detail about something that I've glossed over, which is variables and binding. And we'll see that lambda expressions help us to see a little bit about what's going on here. But even if you don't understand lambda expressions, the first bit of what I'm explaining doesn't need lambda expressions. So here's a typical, very simple Haskell program. X is 2, y is x plus 1, z is x plus y times y. So we can evaluate this, right? Y will be 3, and 2 plus 3 times 3 is 11. So the value of z would be 11. Now, the way this works, you might think, if you're used to other programming languages, imperative languages like Java or C, you think x is a variable which is assigned a value, and later we might assign it another value. It's sort of like a box where you put things. That's not how variables work in functional languages, though, because what we say is the variable gets bound to a value, right? And it's just like marriage. Once a variable is bound, it is bound for life. Okay, it's not like marriage. You can't divorce a variable from its value. So x throughout the rest of the program, throughout the whole program, is always 2. And the way we indicate that is we talk about the scope of x. So we talk about where in the program are we allowed to write x once x has been bound. And the answer is anywhere. So when we write x here and when we write x here, it's referring to this x, which is 2. So this boldface thing we call the binding occurrence. The blue stuff we call the scope. That's the whole place where x can appear. And these italicized things are the occurrences of x, which stand for the bound value. So similarly, right, the scope of y is the whole program. Notice, including earlier in the program, in case we were using recursive definitions. And again, this is the binding occurrence, and these are bound occurrences. The blue bit is the scope. The scope's the same for everything here. Similarly for z. Notice that the scope of these three variables, right, also includes, they're still bound when you get a prompt to which you can type things. So if I type z, it refers to this z here. So these are the buzzwords you need to know, right? Binding occurrence, bound occurrence, and scope of the binding. And of course, the particular names you pick don't matter. So you can pick any names you want as long as they're used consistently. So instead of using x and x, I can use Xavier and Xavier. Right, I can replace Y by Yolanda, Z by Zeus. Right, it doesn't have to be a name beginning with the same letter. Any name at all would work. Now, the same thing goes on with functions. So now when I say f of x is g of x applied to x plus 1, and g of x and y is x plus y times y, f and g are bound. Let's first look at the arguments, x and y. So x is bound, right? This is the binding occurrence. Notice that this is the binding occurrence, but the bound value is going to be occur here. Right? X will be bound to 2 when we apply f to 2. And then we apply g to x and x plus 1. So the scope of x is now the right-hand side of the definition it appears in. Not the whole program. Right? Notice there's another x here. That's a different x. Not the same x. So this is why scopes are important. If the scope was always the whole program, that would be easy. But the scope of a variable bound in a function definition is the right-hand side of that definition. So this x has this scope. It's a different x. If I wanted to rename them, I would rename them independently. So this might be Xavier, and this might be, oh damn, I don't know any other names beginning with X. Does anybody know another name beginning with X?
Zena.
Sorry?
Zena.
Venus.
Zena.
Zena. Zena. Excellent. So this is Xavier, and this is Zena. Right? So we would have here F of Xavier is G of Xavier, and Xavier plus 1, and G of Zena, and Yolanda is Zena plus Yolanda times Yolanda. Right? And then the scope of Y, again, is just here. So if we used Y here, it would be an error. Now, the scope of F, F is defined at the top level, so the scope of F is the whole program, including the body of F. Now, we haven't used that here, but in general, that's very important, right? What does it let us do? Because the scope of a function definition includes the body of that function. Recursion, correct. And then, of course, similarly for G, its scope is everything. Now, there's two other buzzwords you need to know that are very helpful, which are formal parameter and actual parameter. Right? So X is a formal parameter, and the corresponding actual parameter is any place where that function F is applied. So where it's defined, X is a formal, and where it's applied, F is an actual. Right? This is the whole essence of the power of functions, right? Because we can define it once, but apply it many, many, many times. So we might have F of 2 here, and F of 3 somewhere else, and F of 42 in another place. So you define the function once, but it can be applied many times. And in the function body, we use a formal, which is replaced each time by the actual. So it's because one formal occurrence can be replaced by many actual occurrences, that's where the whole power of functions comes from. But that's how we can use any function we define, like the sum of the squares of the positives. We can apply it to many different lists. And similarly, here X and Y formals. And notice, right here, here's a call of G. Here's a definition of G. So notice that in this case, X is the formal, and X is also the actual, but they're different X's. Right? This is the X that was bound here. So we've got an actual value bound to a formal value. They happen to both be X. Here we have the actual value X plus 1 bound to the formal Y. Right? So here they really are different. Everybody's looking suitably, just slightly confused. Are there any good questions? Yes?
I have a kind of a side question. Can we apply pairing to the first line of F of X is G of X plus 1?
So curring is something that we use to turn a function of two arguments into a function of one argument. So indeed, curring would apply to the second line, because G has two arguments. Similarly, this application of G, we can consider G applied to X, which returns a function that's applied to X plus 1.
So if we wanted to apply to the first function at the first line, would we have to swap X and X plus 1?
No. No, everything stays in the same order. Okay, let me go on. And there it is with everything rewritten. You can still use it. Oh, here I used Xerox rather than Zena. So here's another way of doing this, right? F of X is Z. Here's a where clause, where Y is X plus 1 and Z is X plus Y times Y. What is the scope of variables bound? So here's X is our formal variable. Its scope is the entire function definition. The scope of a variable bound in the where clause is the entire function definition also. Right? So Y could be used anywhere here. Indeed, it is used down here. Z can be used anywhere. Indeed, it is used up in the function body. So that's this, how binding and scope and where clauses work. Any question about that? And then F is, of course, bound everywhere. It's bound in the body. It's bound, right, X, Y, Z. If I tried to write X at the main line here, right, the scope, or Z at the main line, let's say. Say I wrote Z here. The scope of Z is just this definition, right? So if you write Z here, it'll say, Z? What Z? I don't know any Zs. So you need to know what the scope is. But the scope of F is everything, including the main thing. So we can write F of 2, and that's fine. So this binding occurrence matches up with this bound occurrence. If elsewhere in the program I say y is 5, then this y is defined at the top level, so we can use it after a prompt. And notice that this y and this y are very different. So indeed, when we said y times y here, it means this y, not that one. And then finally, of course, I could define a function in a where clause. So now I've got f of x is g of x plus 1, where g of y is x plus y times y. Oh, that one's a little bit tricky. What's going on there? So notice that the scope of x is the entire definition, including here. Right? So once we've written f of x, x can be used anywhere, including in the where clause. Now y, right, its scope, it's not defined up here. We've got function definition, so y is only defined in the body of the function. And f is defined at the top level, so it's defined everywhere. G is not defined at the top level, so if I wrote g of 3 here, it would say, what are you talking about? I don't know any g. The scope of g is only the body of the function definition. OK? Question?
Since the actual occurrence is bound, since the actual parameter is bound to the formal parameter, if you typed in f2, then fx, would fx return nothing, or would it return an error?
Sorry, if I typed in okay, so recall, the only x we can see is that one whose scope is the function body, right? The scope of x doesn't include the main line. So what would happen if you wrote f of x here? Well, if I wrote f of x here, what would x be? Closest you could say is x would be x. Sorry?
So it only is the definition in the main. It wouldn't look inside the scope of the function.
No. And it can't, because right, it's the argument of the function that tells it what x is. So if we wrote x there, we would have no idea what was going on. Right. And of course, if we wrote a second function definition with g, and we wrote g in the main line, it would be the top level g you got, not the nested G. So it's only things at the top level that are defined in the main body. Yes? Sorry? Where I had y equals 5. Oh, yes. Somewhere. There. Right. What happens if I use y in the definition of f? Well, as it happens, I have used y in the definition of f. So which y does it use? Right, so if you've got an outer definition and an inner definition, it always picks the inner definition. That's called shadowing. Right, here's a really weird case. What if I use F to define F? Right, don't do this. but you're allowed to do it. It always picks the inner one. This is an example of shadowing. So if I then wrote F there, it's not recursive. It's using that F, not that F. Right, and here's all the things with formals and actuals that we saw before, right? So here the formal Y is bound to the actual X plus 1. And actually going back for a moment, the formal X is bound to the actual 2, right? So this partly goes to your question, what would happen if you wrote an X there? Well, it really wouldn't make sense to write X there because X is only bound to whatever we write there. So it can't know what X is till we tell it what the argument of F is. Oh, once you've finished applying the function, does X still have meaning? Absolutely not. It's only while the function is being applied that X has meaning. Right? And we know from looking at recursive things that each application of the function X may have a different meaning. That's how recursion works. Now, I've just shown you all the rules for how binding works. One reason I told you about lambda expressions today is I now want to show you how you can use lambda expressions to explain every single thing I just showed you. Right, so there's actually a nice uniform way of explaining everything just using lambda expressions. But first, right, let's just see how binding works with lambda expressions themselves. Right, so right, we know we can't write that. Right, we know we can write that. Now we've got two occurrences of X here, right? Here's a binding occurrence, and X is bound within the body of the lambda expression. That will be the scope of X. Notice it doesn't scope over here. That's a different X. Right? Here's the other binding occurrence and its scope. So now here's what I promised you. We can actually explain binding in terms of lambda expressions. Right, we always saw that we can sort of explain currying in terms of lambda expressions. We can also explain binding in terms of lambda expressions. So here's the key rule. It's very easy. Whenever you write n where x is equal to m, it's the same as writing lambda x with body n applied to m. Also, if I wrote let x equal m in n, that's the same as this. Right? Why is that? Because this means evaluate n with x everywhere replaced by m. What does this mean? It means, well, take the function, its actual is x, its formal is m, replace the actual x in the body m everywhere by m. Okay, so these two things mean exactly the same. Is it clear why they mean exactly the same? And then, right, if we're doing a function definition, right, we've seen function definitions like f of x equals n. Of course, lambda expression tells us exactly what to do there. If we're saying f of x is n, that's really the same as saying f is lambda x dot n. Okay. If we use patterns, it would be the same still saying lambda x dot and then some conditionals and some selectors to do the pattern matching in ways we've seen before. So function definitions can, of course, be explained just as an ordinary variable definition, which defines a lambda expression. But then ordinary variable definitions can also be expressed as lambda expressions. So everything can be expressed as a lambda expression. So if I wrote f of 2, where f of x is x plus y times y, where y is x plus 1, well, right, that's the same as saying, right, f of x is all of this, is the same as saying f is lambda x all of this. But now I've got just an ordinary where expression. I can rewrite that. Right here I had where y is x plus 1. I can write that at body thingy. X plus y times y, where y is x plus 1, becomes lambda y, body, x plus y times y, applied to x plus 1. That was the rule we just saw. And then here's another expression, where expression. It's So we can do the same thing. F equals thingy, and then F applied to 2, where F is equal to thingy, becomes lambda F, F applied to 2, applied to thingy, the thing we want X to be. Sorry, the thing we want F to be, which is itself a lambda expression. So this whole thing involving wheres and function definitions and so on just turns into one lambda expression. And we know the rule for evaluating lambda expressions. Take the formal and replace it by the actual. So we can just take this expression, right? This says F should be replaced by this thing. So I do that. And then what have we got now? X should be replaced by 2. So I do that. And then Y should be replaced by its argument, which is 3, so I do that, I get the answer. So absolutely everything can be explained in terms of lambda expressions. Isn't that cool? Right? This very simple idea that a logician who knew nothing about computer programming, because computers hadn't been invented yet, has exactly the right technique for explaining everything. And everything I told you about scope you can explain by just saying, well, the scope of a bound variable in a lambda expression is the body of the lambda expression. Question?
Are lambda expressions recursion and action?
Ah! The one thing a lambda expression is not is recursive. Right? So the scope of the bound variable is the thing. And then you might say, well, what do I do for a recursive definition? So there's one extra trick for that, which I haven't shown you. Okay. I didn't want to show you because it would hurt your brain, but you asked. So the one extra trick you need is you need one recursive definition. So fix of something takes the thing and applies it to fix of the thing. And then a recursive definition can be rewritten as, well, let's see. If you add a recursive definition of factorial, it would become lambda fact blah, 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 something involving fact, which is OK. But then to get the factorial function itself, you take fixed of that whole thing, which defines fact to be fact. So recursion you get out using that trick. And then the last step you need is there is a non-recursive definition to fix, which is this one. So this is equivalent to saying, oh gosh, can I remember how this goes? Yes, it's lambda x, f, x, x. Oh god, I can't even remember. I think it's that. No. Damn, I don't remember the definition of fix. It's either that or it's, I can't remember it off the top of my head. But there is a definition that's non-recursive. Okay, that's additional material. We're not going to do that. But what I am going to do is just go back and show you the bit that I skipped. We have one more bit of shorthand. If you write a binary operator with an argument to its left or right, that's just shorthand for that thing applied to the operator, right? So greater than 0 is shorthand for lambda x, x greater than 0. 2 times is shorthand for lambda x, 2 times x. So notice that where the x goes, whether it's before or after, depends on where the operator goes. It goes in the missing slot. So 2 up arrow, that's exponentiation, is short for lambda x 2 up arrow x. So that's 2 raised to the power, whereas up arrow 2 is shorthand for lambda x, x up arrow 2. So this is 2 raised to a power, exponentiation. This is squaring. So you recall our thing with lambda x, x times x, and lambda x, x greater than 0. Using sections, we can now write this really compactly. Fold r plus 0. Map square, filter, positive. And we can get even more compact by defining the composition operator. So composition takes two functions and apply f and g and an argument x, and applies g to x, and then applies f to the result. So f dot g applied to x is the same as f of g of x. You can work out the types, right? X will be a value of type A. G is a function from A to B. And then f takes a B and returns a C. So f composed with g is a function that takes an A and returns a C. Right? G takes the A to a B, f takes the B to a C. So for instance, if I wrote pos dot square applied to 3, that's of course the same as positive of square of 3. Square of 3 is 9, so that's the same as positive of 9, which is true. The way to think of this is, right, if I want the positive square function, I could say, take x, square it, see if it's positive. Or I could just say, square your argument and see if the result is positive. Compose the two functions. So there's the two things written two ways. And that means, right, I don't need to talk about my argument x's at all if I want to compose these three things. I can just use composition. Notice I haven't put parentheses in here because composition is associative. It doesn't matter where they go. So f, which is find the positive numbers, square them, and find the sum, could just be filter the things that are greater than 0, map the squaring function over that list, and then fold that list using plus and 0. So now we've written something in a completely pointless style. Now, if you want to write things in a more pointed style, I'm perfectly happy with that. But when you start to think at the function level, then you can combine smaller functions into bigger functions and bigger functions. It's a really neat way of thinking about things that can be extremely powerful. We'll see other examples of combining functions to make bigger functions later on. Okay, so any other questions? Yes. You gain anything other than writing less code. So as you can see, right, the amount of code you save is relatively small. So it's probably not worth doing for just saving writing little code unless you're really familiar with it. The main reason that I teach this is A, it's very cool, and B, when you begin to start thinking this way, you can think in terms of combining smaller functions to get bigger functions and combining those to get bigger still functions and so on. That's a very powerful technique. So that's the main reason for offering this technique, not just that it saves you a small number of parentheses. Although notice that, right, sometimes you're going to combine 10 functions in a row. That's not so uncommon. If you're combining 10 functions in a row, doing it this way, you're going to get lots of nested parentheses, whereas doing it this way, you're not. So all of a sudden, thinking at the functional level can be a big advantage. The other thing that I've taught you is how everything can be explained very uniformly in terms of lambda expressions. Sometimes they'll be convenient to use in terms of your program, but also, as you've seen, everything about binding can be explained using lambda expressions. That was why Church introduced them, that the whole notion of binding could be explained just with this one construct, and anything that does binding could be reduced to this one construct, and that turned out to be very uniform and powerful. So that's the main takeaway I want you to take from this lesson, right? When you have a really tough job, especially one involving binding, that it's a job for lambda expressions. Thanks very much. Have fun with the class exam. So I'll see you next Monday, and our next lecture will be Tuesday. Thanks again.
Definition, Haskell knows on which list to apply this thing, because we don't have like.
But when you apply f, it will know which list to apply it to.
Yeah, but we define as f to have list of integers, but we don't say like apply this to x as or something like that.
Sorry, say that again.
We have like list of integers, but we don't have apply f to x as. We say it on the main, but not on the definition of the function. I mean, we don't have apply to something to x as like the first definition.
Right. So you saw that pattern previously with compose and some other things in the notes, right? So the reason that it knows what to apply to, oops, right, is because of this definition of composition. It says when you finally get an argument to the function, just apply all the compose things to it.
Yeah, but we don't get an argument. We don't have such.
Sure you do, right? Eventually we're going to write f applied to something. It's only when we write f applied to something that it knows what list to take.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me just log out here.
Oh, just a quick question. See the reason why we can miss the formal parameter in the second line? Yeah.
Yeah, you can leave it up because of.
It's because of the composition.
Right. Right. Just like defining. Where else the example? Right. Just like this.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Right, and it works because of that.
Okay. So in the exam, are we awarded marks in the way we define our code, or just by getting the correct answer by solving the problem?
If you do a completely correct solution, I can tell it's a completely correct solution. You will get full credit.
Right. Okay. So that doesn't matter how you write the code.
I wouldn't say that. I will be a lot happier if you write the code nicely.
Oh, of course, yeah. But it sort of doesn't matter. As long as you don't do it, sort of like something crazy. Something really long-winded.
Exactly.
You're just, as long as it's short to the point, it makes
right.
sense.
If you have a chance to write x plus 0 or x, write x.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And that one's important because I've seen people write things like something or false. Or a Boolean expression equals true. Well, the Boolean expression equals true exactly when the Boolean expression is true.
Okay.
So it's.
Okay.
So just to clarify, what I was talking about with the perfect problem was. I had something like this. And I ran it with 1 and 2, or the 1 and 3. I expected to return true, but it was that B was somehow only applied within this function. Because it would remember the definition of B, even though G would only be asked to return up. I can't read it. It's like an ADR. Function ADR X1.
No.
Find G minus the Y, and return G plus X. I'm saying if you ran it a second time, I expected to use the first part of 1. And I just.
Even in C, I don't think that works. I don't think the sign works that way.
I was wondering if it